From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Hi, I'm from North Beach.
I'm from Pacific Heights.
I live at 24th and Valencia.
I live in the Outer Sunset by the beach.
I listen to KALW from the Panhandle for the last 12 years.
Coming up, we meet people who address the aftermath of a police shooting.
The most important to me is like clients or other activists who say, you are the first people who listen to me.
Then a conversation with world-renowned photographer Annie Leibovitz you won't hear anywhere else.
We were doing a story actually on the Beach Boys. I remember the story, and he said to me, well, I have enough. And I said, you do? How do you know when you have enough?
And we'll hear about the mastermind behind a South Bay mystery mansion.
I like it when people realize that Mrs. Winchester was actually ahead of her time in a lot of ways.
Stories of powerful women today on Cross Currents. Today in San Francisco's Mission District, police shot and killed a man holding a knife. Police say they first fired 4 beanbag rounds to try to restrain him and then fired at least 7 gunshots. San Francisco Police Chief Greg Suhr addressed the media this morning.
That large kitchen knife was found on the ground beside the subject who was transported to General Hospital and is in surgery now in very, very critical condition.
The man died in surgery. Last year, American police killed close to 1,200 people, but not everyone becomes a household name afterwards. If names like Alex Nieto or Alice Brown ring a bell, it's because local organizations and activists got the word out when they were killed by police. One group in San Francisco's Bayview District does more than coordinate political action. They help the individual families left behind. In this story that first aired in 2015, KALW's Rachel Wong brings us the story of the Idris Stelly Foundation.
This isn't the story of another police shooting. It's the story of what happens after a police shooting, especially one in particular.
The night he died, I felt my soul tearing apart. He was my only child.
Misha Irizarry's son, Idris Stelly, was 23 when he was killed in 2001 by San Francisco police at a movie theater during what was possibly a psychotic episode. Stelly was bipolar. But his mother says he was so much more.
He was a web designer, was an artist. There was nothing that was impossible to Idris.
And suddenly, he was gone. As the police's version of the story made the rounds in the local news, his mother desperately tried to figure out what really happened. She didn't get much sympathy. Some people felt the police had done the right thing. She realized,
I gotta take care of people around me because if I start thinking too much about what happened, I'm gonna lose my mind.
So she started the Idris Stelly Foundation in her son's honor to address issues of police misconduct. She's been working relentlessly on it ever since.
Hello!
Misha Irizarry describes herself as an old dyke, 67 years young. She's a multiracial woman originally from the Basque Country in Spain. She wears her hair in long, tightly woven braids pulled back into a ponytail. When she speaks, she often holds her hand to her heart.
We pay attention. We care.
These days, she's disabled. She walks with a cane and suffers from a respiratory illness. Irizarry's team includes 2 younger activists, Rebecca Ruiz and Jeremy Miller, and a handful of rotating interns. The Idris Stelly Foundation has no website, no funding, and it isn't registered as a nonprofit. They run the whole thing out of Irizarry's one-bedroom apartment in Bayview Hunters Point. They're about as grassroots gets. They're kind of like family.
Jeremy actually reminds me a lot of my child. They are similar in appearance and in energy.
Sometimes Irizarry mothers Miller.
I do everything. I know you, and you're gonna say, "I do that, no problem. I'll do that." Next thing, you got 12 things on your.
It'll get done
and
if
you
I
don't
say
get
I'm gonna
sleep.
Well, sleep is whatever.
Yeah.
Sleep is a luxury.
One of the things that keeps Misha Irizarry up at night, literally, is her foundation's 24-hour crisis hotline for victims of police brutality and their families. When I ask Irizarry where that number rings, she raises her flip phone in the air.
It's under my pillow at night.
And people do call, even at 2 a.m.
I felt like, oh, Lord. And then I listen, and then I don't think about me anymore.
The San Francisco Police Department says they get calls from families of those killed by police, too. But it's pretty different. That's according to Monica McDonald, a public information officer with the SFPD.
We assign a liaison to the family, and they're available 24 hours a day.
Their phone line is not for emotional support. It's more about answering questions about the investigation and other police-related matters.
That person works out of our office at Media Relations.
They're the same people who speak to journalists, like me. McDonald says the SFPD does have a unit that provides free psychological services, but it's for police, not members of the public who may have been impacted by police actions.
A lot of times families have their own resources already. They have their church, they have their family members, they have other stuff like that that they lean on as well. If there is a trust issue, that's not maybe not something they would ask us.
And there is nothing nobody can do to let me get, for me to gain their trust anymore. Trust is gone.
That's Angela Nagy. She's the mother of O'Shane Evans. Evans was killed by SFPD officers in October 2014 when he was 26. He was shot while sitting in the driver's seat of his mother's car. Nagy says she called the police department repeatedly, even showed up in person, but it took months to get her car back, which she relies on to get to and from work. When her car was returned, it still had blood, glass, and bullet holes.
I just finished cleaning the blood out of my car.
You had to do it yourself?
Yes. Get it down, vacuum all the broken windows and stuff like that.
Nagy says she was lost until she and her family met Misha Irizarry about a week after her son's death. Irizarry and her team helped Nagy fundraise for funeral expenses. They let her know her legal rights to file a complaint or a lawsuit, and they connected her to an attorney.
Those are my shoulder to cry on. Those people are everything to me. I'm not getting any therapy. Those people are my therapists.
Like Irizarry, Nagy has become politically active. Today, she's advocating for a young Guatemalan immigrant named Amilcar Perez Lopez at a town hall meeting addressing his death.
O'Shane was an immigrant. I am an immigrant. This is an immigrant right here.
Yes. The SFPD holds meetings like these a few days after someone is killed by police. Police Chief Greg Sir uses the meeting to share the official story.
The officers were approximately 5 to 6 feet away when the suspect charged one of the officers with a knife raised overhead.
But Sir's description differs from some witness accounts.
I get angry. People are frankly honest.
That's Idris Stelly Foundation's Jeremy Miller. Miller says he comes to these town hall meetings for a couple reasons. One, to be accessible to people like Angela Nagy. And two, to be noticed by police and the police commission.
I come to remind them that we're still here. We're still here. You are still being watched. There are still people in the community that are paying very close attention to what you're doing, and we're not going to let this go.
Miller says he met Irizarry about a decade ago. He has a day job, but on nights and weekends, he's working for the Idris Stelly Foundation. Miller says he joined because he was struck by the lack of resources for victims of police brutality.
Victim services won't touch you. You have to fight to get legal representation.
Miller might work with clients for days, months, even years. Clients like Chris Brown. Miller met Brown at the funeral of Brown's older brother, Raheem. Raheem was 20 when he was killed by an Oakland Unified School District police officer. He was sitting in a parked car close by a high school with his friend when he was approached by two officers and a scuffle left him dead. Chris, who was just 18 at the time, was in shock when he heard the news.
So our first interaction actually wasn't all that great. He was angry at the whole world.
Miller initially counseled the whole family, mom, dad, and Raheem's five brothers. But now, 4 years later, he's mainly in touch with Chris.
The kid that I met versus where he's at now, I mean, he's just grown up so much.
He's helped me, you know, grow, far as like being able to trust someone that's not my family.
That's Chris Brown. He says he calls Jeremy Miller his uncle now. We're standing in his bedroom. It's the morning after one of Brown's graveyard shifts. He's a security guard.
I work every day.
no days off. Most of my days, I don't have no day off. 14, 16 hours a day.
Brown hasn't always worked this much. He says he dropped out of school in ninth grade and has cycled through many jobs through the years. And after his older brother died, his family unraveled. His mother.
It hit her, you know, I guess her heart. I mean, it kind of like made her like not want to, I guess, communicate. It made it distant.
They all struggled to go on without Raheem.
You know, he is like our balance, you know, and physically, he's not there. Reality. I don't accept it, but I'm coping with it.
Last year, Brown started making music. He says he tries to write things Raheem might have rapped about.
Still bullshit, so I stay fearless. Through all the stress, will I just die? Which way do I go?
Idris Stelly Foundation founder Misha Irizarry says even with all their activism and lobbying, connecting with those left behind comes first.
The most important to me is like clients or other activists who say, you are the first people who listened to me. You gave me faith in humanity again. You allowed me to stop feeling that I wanted to die. You stopped me from going to kill a cop.
So she keeps working.
Being able to help others is, in a way, a very selfish way that I'm getting my own vicarious healing.
Every time another person is shot by police, Irizarry goes right back to the night her son died. But in helping other families recover, she picks up the pieces again. For Cross Currents, I'm Rachel Wong.
That story originally aired in 2015. To see images of the Idris Stelly Foundation at work, head to our website, kalw.org, click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Most months, you can see photographer Annie Leibovitz's portraits of influential women on the covers of magazines like Vanity Fair and Vogue. Everyone from Hillary Clinton to Serena Williams to a mostly nude Amy Schumer have been in front of her lens. Her current exhibition, Women, updates a book of portraits she made with Susan Sontag back in 1999. The images, now on display at Chrissy Field, reflect the changing roles women occupy today. Leibovitz sat down with KALW's Lauren Schiller to talk more about her work and process.
What are some of the stories that you wanted to tell with this collection?
You know, I started with the premise of the original project from 1999, women's book that was done with Susan Sontag. At the time, I was reluctant to even take it on because I thought it was such a big, broad project. But it was extraordinary to have this opportunity to go back to this project and update it and add a new set of pictures to it. I knew I had a core group that I needed to get started with right away. And then I thought as the year goes on, I will add to it and it will continue to be that work in progress. It was interesting because a lot of women said yes right away, but then it just, their schedules were extremely difficult.
Right.
And it took some time to really, you know, to really, really get going.
How much do you think has changed generally? Well, I mean, in the way we think about women and beauty and power.
I mean, I think it's interesting on the board is, you know, I'm seeing that when women sit for their portraits, they come in now with a better sense of themselves and more confidence. And that in itself is different. Yeah. I mean, I don't think as a photographer, I was really struggling with how we should look. But I think we as a society were struggling with how we should look and how we should act and how we should come across. And now it's completely accepted to just be yourself, you know, on some level.
Have your kids, you've got three girls,
yes,
right? Have they taken an interest in photography?
Not really. I mean, they have their own lives. I mean, they're very busy with their own lives. They go to school and they happen to be out here with me this time because it's spring break. But they aren't any more interested in than other kids with, you know, only the older one has an iPhone, and she does use it as a camera. And I've bought them cameras for trips, little sure shots, and they don't dislike taking pictures. I don't think it's like they want to be a photographer or anything. No. I'm hoping that they find their own way and they do what makes them happy. I mean, I loved as a young girl using photography. It really helped discover who you are. I mean, but today we all have those iPhones, and it's on some level you don't need to carry a camera anymore. You can take pictures. Now, the selfie thing, it's probably a little bit crazy, but on the other hand, it's kind of great for self-discovery. So
it's crazy as in too many of them.
No, I mean, I think everything, you know, I really trust us as a people. I think we're smart, and I think we sort of go through, you know, different kinds of things. I think after a while people will be kind of tired of that and do something else. I mean, it's like, it's right now, it's like, it can be entertaining, it can be silly, it can be something to do, you know. It can be a memory, it can be a souvenir. I think it's an incredible time for the iPhone camera. And I remember photographing Vanessa Redgrave a couple years ago, and she pulls out the iPhone and shows me her grandchildren. So it is it's the family wallet, you know, with the family scrapbook in it.
Right.
So.
What's the best advice that you've ever been given about capturing the essence of a subject?
Well, on the 1972 Rolling Stone tour, and my hero, my God, Robert Frank was on that tour, and I got to stand near him. He was photographing the tour for the Rolling Stones, and he saw me taking pictures, and he turned to me and he said, you know, you can't get every picture. And to a young person, that was really, I know it sounds really like it doesn't mean much, but you worry about being able to get the picture or take the picture. And, you know, I would be as good as the last picture I took. So this was kind of like a relief to know that you weren't going to get it all the time, although it's, you know, we kind of know that. And how does that apply to actually taking a portrait? I think I've had to make my own way, you know, as far as that is concerned. But I do think that the advice is all there in books. And there's just such great photography books, you know, available to us. You know, there's great portrait photographers, you know, Cecil Beaton, Irving Penn, Richard Avedon. You know, I highly recommend looking through work that's been done, and we'll see what people, you know, have done. There is some obsession involved, of course. It's almost, it's a little insanity, yeah. I think the trick is as you get older, is don't make it a long session. Because, yeah, when I was younger, I didn't know when to go home. Yeah, I used to stay in those shoots for a long time.
And did you ever end up with the last photo you took?
Sure. As opposed to the first photograph or the one in the middle? Or
just thinking about, you know, staying longer than
having a long session.
I
remember David Felton, who was a writer at Rolling Stone. We were doing a story actually on the Beach Boys. I remember the story. And he said to me, well, I have enough. And he was the writer, and I said, how do you know when you have enough? I mean, like, what's enough? You know, like, it didn't make any sense to me at the time. But that certainly is one of the problems, is you can always do better, or you can always, you know. But I think I work now towards having something that's good enough. Is it going to change photography? You know, it's not going to happen all the time. You know, is it going to be a great moment? Not going to happen all the time. Those things are few and far between. I'm lucky enough that if you do this your whole lifetime, you do have a couple moments that are kind of like, have nothing to do with you. They just happen to be the fact that you're there, and you feel like a medium. And there's just things that have happened that just because you happen to be there.
Well, thank you so much, Annie.
Hey, you're welcome.
That was photographer Annie Leibovitz talking to KELW's Lauren Schiller. Annie Leibovitz's series Women is on display at Crissy Field through April 17th. And if you like this interview, it's part of the KELW podcast Inflection Point, a program devoted to bringing you conversations with women who are changing the status quo. Find it on our podcast page at kalw.org/subscribe. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's KALW's Julie Kane.
This week, we're bringing you a story from our Audiograph archives. It's a story of a place a lot of you know a lot about.
That was the Winchester Mystery House.
I believe that that is the Winchester Mystery House.
The Winchester Mystery House.
Winchester Mystery House.
The Mystery House.
The Winchester Mystery House.
The Winchester Mystery House.
The Winchester Mystery House.
The San Jose Mystery House.
The Winchester Mystery House.
Winchester Mystery House.
At least I think so.
The Winchester
Mystery House.
Winchester Mystery House.
Winchester Mystery House.
The Winchester Mystery House.
The Winchester House in Santa Clara.
I think the recording was from the Winchester Mystery House. Bye.
Winchester Mystery House. Now, KALW's Nina Gensler-Debs didn't want to be left out, so we sent her on a tour. Here's who she met.
So, hello and welcome to the Winchester Mystery House.
My name is Maggie Reyes, and I am a tour guide here at the Winchester Mystery House.
My name is Maggie, and I will be your guide today on this 65-minute tour of Mrs. Winchester's beautiful but bizarre 160-room Victorian mansion.
They give anywhere between 3 and 6 tours a day, depending. But I feel like I could walk that house for 100 years and still not see things that I didn't see before. I mean, her attention to detail was out of this world.
Well, underneath these original wood planks is an original zinc-lined metal floor. So this floor will never rust. If you have a look out to the right and out that doorway, you will see what we call the 7-11 staircase. You go down 7 steps and up 11 steps, and you remain on the second floor.
When I first started working here, like many people, I did think that it was chaotic and didn't make sense. But after I spent some time here walking around, the house actually really makes sense and feels right. I feel like there is a method to the madness. It doesn't feel like madness after you spend time here.
If you're confused, I can make it easier for you. We go up to go up to go up. We go down to go up to go down. Up to go down to go up, or down to go down to go down. Hope that cleared it up. Okay, we are now gonna go to the linen rooms. We're gonna go through the south conservatory. There is a window in the floor, so please watch your step and follow me.
I like it when people realize that Mrs. Winchester was actually ahead of her time in a lot of ways. I like it when that light bulb goes on.
Over here we do have a shower that could shower a person front and back, neck and shoulders down. Ladies in those days liked to preserve their elaborate hairdos, and they didn't like to get their heads wet.
I think it's very important to come to this house because it is history, of course. And she was in San Jose before Google was here, before Netflix was here, before any of them were here.
So this is your final stop on your tour today. And if you're feeling a little bit tired, you absolutely have a right to, because you walked about a mile through a mansion that cost $5.5 million to build, has 160 rooms, 24,000 square feet, 10,000 windows. We actually have more windows than the Empire State Building. They do have more glass, but we have more windows. So 10,000 windows, 2,000 doors, 52 skylights, 47 fireplaces, 40 bedrooms, 40 staircases, 17 chimneys, 13 bathrooms, 6 kitchens, 3 elevators, 2 basements, and 1 shower in this 24,000 square foot mansion. 1 shower.
I really love that list, and it reminds me that I still haven't ever been to the Winchester Mystery House. I really need to go. And here's another place I'd love to visit.
So here's another example of queen termites.
Oh, whoa.
So you can see it's got this tiny little brown body here, and the white stuff is just her abdomen full of eggs.
Oh my God.
Look at that spider.
Ew. So we have one of the world's best collection of bed bugs.
All these guys. You gotta lift up the things, remember?
Think you know what that is and where we recorded it? Give us a call and tell us. 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. We love hearing from you. Thanks so much for listening, and thanks for playing. I'm Julie Kane.
Thanks, Julie. And if you're an Audiograph fan, subscribe to our podcast. You can hear Cross Currents and Audiograph whenever you want and catch up on past episodes. Go to kalw.org/subscribe. Our team includes Shireen Adil, Leela Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Ian Lewis, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, James Rowlands, Raja Shah, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley-Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by the Bay Area band called Blame Sally. They're one of four groups coming together for the benefit of longtime KLW program host and board operator Kevin Vance. Kevin has had some problems recently, health-wise and otherwise, so a show is planned for his benefit on Saturday at Ashkenaz in Berkeley. Doors open at 7 p.m., so we hope to see you there. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.